Welcome to Tell Me Your Story. New paradigms for a new world, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Monday mornings at 1 a.m. Streaming live at those times at richarddugan.com. And then also archiving the programs on the radio shows page at richarddugan.com, the radio shows page. Also on SoundCloud and iTunes. We do have Facebook and we do have Twitter. Don't spend a lot of time there, but we encourage you to go to our guest website. We'll be giving you a website here in just a moment so that you can continue to follow through on the conversation that we are going to have today. Just to let you know up front, this is going to be one that is probably not going to be a whole lot of fun to listen to, but we certainly hope that we've got some solutions for you here on the program. Talking today about a new book that's out, Prosecuted But Not Silent, Courtroom Reform for Sexually Abused Children. And we'll explain to you why this is an important program and topic for this broadcast, dealing with new paradigms for a new world, because we've got a situation in this country, if not around the world. We're going to find out a little bit more about that from our guest here on the program. And basically, according to some information released through news outlets, there was in the 90s epidemic of children being court ordered to live with their sexual abusers. It continues today. Over 58,000 children a year are forced to live with their abusers, which in my estimation doesn't make a lot of sense. Since the airing of this particular segment on CNN, and no changes have been placed, have taken place to stop this ridiculous and horrendous practice, and the broken family court system continues to enforce these practices as policies. All I can tell you, folks, is it sounds to me the equivalent thereof of forcing people here on the in California whose houses are on fire to go back into their homes while they're burning. I mean, what's the difference? It's a crazy system, and we're going to talk about this crazy system and maybe talk about some of the reforms with our special guest, the author of the book, again, Prosecuted But Not Silent, Marilee McLean. Thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Well, wait, what a great introduction, Richard. I really appreciate that introduction. Couldn't have done it better myself. Thank you so much.
Pleasure
to be on your show.
I'm perplexed at the whole situation, but I want to deal with something at the front end of this program. Get it out of the way. Because I brought this up in our conversation a couple of weeks ago when we talked, and I want to get it out of the way first, but also talk about the latest revelations in this whole Me Too movement. And there's now this situation where one of the women who has accused a film producer, who will remain nameless at this point, everybody knows who it is, now this woman has been accused of the same accusations that she accused the movie producer. So now we've got this and again, we're talking adults here. I understand that. But I want to go down the slippery slope that was brought up in the 80s when this whole business of children accusing adults, whether it was parents or teachers or other adults in their lives of abuse. And what was termed the potential false claims that were made, because once an accusation is made against specifically an adult, you got to prove your innocence. And it's like, how do you do that? Because you've got to believe, or at least that's the assertion, is that you have to believe the accuser almost over the one who's been accused. But I thought in this country we were innocent until proven guilty, but unfortunately not in the case of the issue of sexual abuse, whether it's adults on adults or adults on children. Can we talk just briefly about that?
Absolutely. You know, I find that it's horrible what's going on as far as the sexual assault goes on and that kind of thing, but I'm looking at children here, and I'm finding that there are thousands, and I'm not exaggerating, of these cases where children don't make this stuff up. It's very, when they're really little like that, and the things they come up with and statistics will prove that they're not making this up. And it's better to go on the side with a child and look at the safety of the child than, you know, automatically. So I don't find that the perpetrators necessarily are being convicted and the children are being believed. It's really not the case when it comes into family court. There are so many cases where children come forward, disclose the sexual abuse, and the family court is awarding these children to the abuser. Now, this is if it's the parent. Like, most of these cases that I deal with, it's the father that has raped the child, but it's the family court system that is awarding that child to the father and stating the woman is a vindictive ex-wife, she this or that, to make up whatever they do, but the physical evidence can be there, the proof can be there, and they still are going the opposite direction of what should be happening for that child. So I don't really care about the mother or the father. I care about the safety of the child, and that is not happening.
And it's interesting, too, when you're talking about crimes, because this is a crime, crimes in general, when the law enforcement begins its investigation and begins to gather evidence, okay, and this is outside of the realm of sexual abuse. A lot of times when they start gathering the evidence, they begin the process of making a conclusion as to who the guilty party is, even before all of the evidence is gathered. And so they'll haul this person in and they'll, toss him in jail. They'll have their arraignment and bail and blah, blah, blah. But in this situation, as you've stated, the evidence is overwhelming and nothing's done.
Yeah, it's opposite. I mean, I guess what it is, Richard, I'd say is like most people think, you know, it's the boogeyman hiding behind the bush or it's the stranger on the street. But most sexual abuse or child abuse like this is within the family. It's familial. So it's not the boogeyman or the stranger. And so that takes on a different realm. And so when you go into the family court, they're looking at the evidence is really not coming in because it's not an evidentiary hearing. The cases that go to criminal court, which these cases don't, they get stuck in family court. So that judge has a discretion whether to take that information in or not. So there is no real accountability or transparency in that family courtroom. And the civil rights and your human rights can be denied because of the due process problem. If it goes into criminal court, you have to be able to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. Well, in criminal court, a lot of these cases with these children, you won't have enough evidence or the child is too young to state what's happening. But if they go to an advocacy center first, where the advocacy center has forensic interviewers and they document it all videotaped, that's a much better process. But it's still not happening. The DAs are not prosecuting. The family court are throwing out the information and awarding custody to the perpetrators. So in the realm, you know, I think we spoke about this earlier, is that if they had a separate court where they have judges trained and they have a jury trial and they have, you know, everything videotaped and a forensic interviewer there, that makes a huge difference. But that hasn't happened yet, so we're way behind in times, and we are sending thousands and thousands of children to live with their abusers, which is causing horrific problems within a society, because that damage those children go through carries with them through life. And a lot of our problems in society come from this issue. As the ACE research study, I'll mention that later if you ask me, but adverse childhood experiences show how much damage this is causing. And we know by the Catholic priests what's happening to these people that have been abused, or any of the survivors out there. So it's time for all of society to take a look at this and know that this is such an important, important issue.
I have to say that when I heard the story out of, Philadelphia, was it?
Pennsylvania.
When I started hearing the story on the newscast, I'm going, wait a minute. I thought we were done with this. I thought this was over and that they had resolved these issues, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the church had finally reined this in. And yet the allegations, the abuse is still going on, according to this particular case that was in the news story. I couldn't believe my ears.
Yeah, I always say, this is one of the things I will say. I go back to to the public, as your listeners listening out there, is that we all got upset about Sandusky, you know, the coach, and molesting the boys, right?
Yeah,
and it was all in the news media, and people were so upset that this Pennsylvania coach, or I think it was Penn State, could do what he did. And we're all upset about the Catholic priest. But the biggest crime of all that's happening is right in our family court. The biggest. The most children being abused and not being protected is within our family court. So, yeah, I think that this has been such a secrecy for so long, and it still is, and it needs not to be. And we know what it does. So, you know, even with you, I guess, on some of the Catholic priest stuff, they showed some of the survivors, and it's horrific. It's horrific, the damage it causes.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that, because one of the aspects of this that just and again, I'm learning about this even as we speak. But what little I do know, in terms of my own upbringing, didn't have those experiences. They're not repressed, blocked memories. But I was bullied in school, and that had an effect on me. Whole different scenario, but still had an effect.
Absolutely.
So tell me about. It seems to me like this process that these children go through, not only the abuse itself, but then the abuse by the judicial system, it seems to me like it's setting up a scenario that this kind of behavior, the potential for this continuation is ripe into the future. They then become the perpetrators as adults, who then perpetrate more children who become adults, and perpetrate against children who become adults, etc. I mean, that just keeps, it never ends.
Yeah, it is a vicious cycle, but it is something that could be, you know, we're never going to stop it entirely. We know that. But it's like, they have, like I brought up again, the ACE study research, Adverse Childhood Experiences, and you go by that, which is Dr. Vincent Folletti did the study back in the 80s, and it shows, you know, wherever a child went through divorce or had been sexually abused or whatever, and it gives you those 10 hard things that children go through and how the outcome of all that is. And if we would just review that and understand that better and take it into our system, and as far as, you know, you're saying the court system doing what they're doing to these children. I believe the abuse is horrific crime, but I believe the crime happening by the courts not protecting these children is even as large. Because I know from the fact that I had a child that was sexually abused and couldn't protect her in the system, and I went through that. I watched that the trauma is telling policemen, telling doctors, telling social workers, telling psychologists as a child, telling your mother, your family, your friends, begging for help, and being that door being shut on you as a child, and then forced to live with your abuser. That trauma is, I don't know, I'm not the child, but that trauma is so huge on top of the trauma with the abuse, the sexual abuse going on. So those kids are getting double whammied.
The phrase that's quite often used when talking about education is that our children are our future, which I abhor that phrase because it doesn't allow kids to be kids. Well, we have a situation right now that's not allowing kids to be kids because of this kind of thing. So tell me about this. We could go further into depth into the problems. What are some of the solutions, if any, that are being instituted or are trying to be instituted to change this process?
Well, I would have to say, you know, there are a lot of people that have written books, number one, a lot of professionals. In my book, the research I did in the back of my book with a lot of the professionals that are involved that are trying to stop this, there's lots of good research out there. So you have... Daniel Saunders, who did a study, research study with the Justice Office on the education of judges and custody evaluators and GAO, Guardian of Lions, to assess a lawyer for the child, to see how these people are coming with this information and understanding what's going on. And it's really a lack of training. So that's one of them. The other thing is we have a position where we're pushing the Safe Child Act so that every state, rather, we have this deal where it's the best interest of the child statute. So when you go into family court, and you got to understand, these are the mothers and fathers going through a divorce that have a problem or whatever, they work it out because they love their children. They find a way to work out that relationship, whether it's a stay-at-home dad, whether it's, you know, a mom and dad splitting up the time, whatever they're doing, but they're going to work it out. These are not the cases we're talking about. We're talking about cases where there's abuse going on, and those are the cases that are going wrong. You don't hand a child over to an abuser at any point, you know, not 50-50, not anything. You know, you wouldn't force a child to go live with Sandusky. You wouldn't force a child to go live with a Catholic priest. Why would you force a child to go live with a parent that's raping them? So that is a whole process. So we put out the Safe Child Act and trying to get that approved in every state with the best interest of the child, that statute that goes into family court. It's the parent that's more able to nurture the relationship with the other parent. Well, obviously, if the child being hurt by one parent or the other, they're not going to want to nurture that relationship. They're just going to want that child safe. So the Safe Child Act is about judges looking at the safety of the child first before making any regards to the best interest of the child, of who the father or the mother is. What's about the safety? And if the safety comes first, a lot of these cases wouldn't go the direction they go if they actually looked at the safety.
Now, you are speaking and have been speaking across the country. I am, well, before I get into this, let me ask you, what about, I realize this is the U.S. judicial system. Is this still a serious problem globally in other, in other developed countries?
I get calls every day from women all across the United States and internationally as well. I get calls from Canada, lots of calls from Canada, which you wouldn't think, England, Australia, I mean everywhere, really pretty much everywhere. And it's not as rampant as what we have here going on in the U.S., and I don't know if that started with the parental alienation syndrome with Richard Gardner back in the 80s or why it's so much prevalent here or just hasn't been uncovered there, but I'm hearing now in Italy it's really coming out, in France, so they're really having to fight that PAS label. And and parental alienation syndrome was brought in the 80s by Dr. Richard Gardner, who self-published his books and sent it to every court in the nation, and all these courts start taking on his theory. And by taking on his theory, we have he states in his own published books, we all have some pedophilia within us, that we have more pity for the pedophile than scorn, that it makes little girls and little boys that are sexual partners. This is actually things that he stated in his books. He was, when I went on CNN International News back in 94, I think it was, there were, he was on the show program with me, and he states that we need to gel these moms, gag these moms, to shut these moms up, not to be able to bring this forward. Well, today, these women are being gelled and gagged every day. And these are not drug addicts or alcoholics or sick women in any way. These are good, loving mothers just trying to do what's right by their children and protect them. And they're being gagged and jailed.
Unbelievable.
Yes, it is.
Sure is. I mean, now I want to go down this road. You speak from firsthand experience. Please tell our listeners your story in that regard.
My story is very long, so I'll try to do the best I can to sum it up.
You have plenty of time.
Okay. Well, I divorced my daughter's father when she was 6 months old. Now, I lived in a domestic violence marriage. I would have to say, you know, in my day, back in the 80s, we didn't have the red flags out there that women have today. There was no internet. There was nobody telling you. I thought a woman with domestic violence had to have black eyes and be beaten. You know, I didn't really know what that consisted of. And I was very much in a domestic violence marriage. And I was physically abused and mostly emotionally abused and coercive control. I lived with a man who, after I divorced him, who stalked me, who put me through so much hell, I can't even begin to tell you. But I was married for 8 years before I filed, and not that I filed a divorce until after my daughter was born, and he treated me so horribly during my pregnancy that I made up my mind I was leaving him after she was born. So, you know, a lot of these abusers jump up the rate of abuse when the woman is pregnant. I don't know why that is. I don't really understand that, but you'll hear a lot of times where the woman is killed when she's pregnant, or just weird, whatever, with an abuser. So anyway, I filed for divorce, and then that nightmare begins. But I figured, you know, he would be a good dad because he was great with kids. I mean, he was very charismatic and charming and good-looking and very intelligent, and he could take kids from 0 to 20 in la-la land within a few seconds. He just was great with kids. And I never dreamed anything like this. And I remember getting out of my marriage and being so afraid he would kill me that I went to a therapist for the first time in my life and told her the truth about my marriage. And she said, "What are you doing to protect yourself, and does he have a gun?" And I thought, wow. You know, I wasn't expecting anything like that. And then later, I had journals that he had written in for many years. And he, a true psychopath, sociopath, narcissist, I don't care, a little bit of all three. But I read those journals. I never really read them while I was married to him. But he left them in the house, and I thought, I'm going to go through those. And I went through them, and I went, oh, my God. He actually planned and plotted how he was going to win me, and now he's met his greatest enemy. She's mine to conquer and destroy. Example, Nietzsche, da-da-da-da, and some real sick stuff. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, look who I've been married to. And I took those to her, copied a lot of them, took them to her, some of the worst excerpts in there, and asked her, what do you think I'm dealing with? And she wrote me back a letter saying he had incognitive behavior, paranoid ideation, and could be the writing of a very disturbed and conflicted individual, and if ever my child was left in his care, she would be unsafe. And I thought, ah, oh, she overreacted. He's sick. He's not that sick. He would never do anything to the baby. So that's where that went. And that is the same thing with most women and these young girls. They get in a relationship with a man like that. They don't even really know. But today they have the red flag, and they know what they're dealing with more so. And I say run. I mean, you see those red flags, you better run, because you will be in it for life if you have a child with that person. So anyway, from that point on, I have full custody of my daughter, so it's not a custody issue. She's 2.5, and she's displaying sexual behaviors and a playhouse with another little boy. And I'm thinking, well, you know, this is before you ever heard about sexual abuse on TV like you do every day to day. So I'm figuring, well, she's probably getting that from his family, and, you know, nothing's happening here. And I kind of shrugged it off, although the daycare provider brought it to my attention. But then maybe a month or so or 2 months from that time, my daughter disclosed sexual abuse to me. I mean, detailed information. And I couldn't believe what I was hearing and seeing. And so I called my sister, who was a nurse at Children's Hospital. I said, what do I do? She said, ask her in the morning what happened. And she repeats the same thing. Don't mention her father's name. See if she repeats the same thing and take her to her pediatrician. So that's what I did. And that started the whole investigation. And I ended up with social services, and that's where my nightmare began. I take her into a visit with her father at social services, and I'm watching him through a glass window with the social worker and my daughter. And as I said, he came across extremely well, and I'm thinking, oh, they're never going to see this. And I'm met by a GAL, which is a guardian ad litem lawyer for the child, and I didn't even know she was on the case. She'd been on it for 4 months, and I'd been up with my daughter all night screaming out in the night what her dad was doing to her, where she would be arching her back off the bed screaming, no, daddy, don't, how we get that 5 and 6 times a night I'm up with her. And I'm thinking, my God, why can't these people see this? And then I actually, in one incident, went to pick her up from her dad's, just before I knew he was abusing her. And he brought her down the stairs. He went down to the door, and I thought that was strange. And he brought her down the stairs, wet, nude, and limp in his arms. And I said, what the hell happened to her? And he said, she's sick. And I said, that's funny. She was fine a few hours ago. And I said, I got her stuff together, and her clothes were strung all over the floor, and got her out of the house. And then when I found out that the abuse was going on, that whole scene used to wake me up at 2 o'clock in the morning. I just shoot straight out on my bed, like in a sweat, going, oh, my God, he was doing it right in front of my face. And I didn't even really know what was going on. And I remember the smirk on his face was that of O.J. Simpson, like, you idiot, Marilee. You know, you don't even get it. And so as time went on, more and more evidence came out on the abuse. 3 doctor's reports from Colorado, 3 hospital reports, from the Child Advocacy and Protection Team, which is one of the top, Dr. Charles Jenny was a top sexual abuse expert in the nation at the time, and 3 police reports. And every time I went to court, I lost. and the GAL was going on PAS. So that data I tell you on that social services, parental alienation syndrome, I met by that GAL, and she said she wants to discuss four things with me. And I go into this little room, and they interrogated me like nothing I'd ever seen on TV, no law show, nothing. And it was, why would your daughter continue to say this if you weren't coaching her? I said, because maybe it's going on. The next question would be, well, I'm going to have you do a psychological evaluation. I'm going to have him do one. I said, good, maybe we'll get to the bottom of this. And she points her finger in my face and says, maybe we'll find out about you. I'm thinking, whoa. And then I said, well, have you read Dr. Baker's report, who states my daughter's being sexually abused? And she said, Dr. Baker's report doesn't state that. Well, the report I just got the day before, and she did state my daughter had been sexually abused and exposed to sexual stimuli. And she had tears in her eyes and said, yes, she's being abused. And the next day, she's telling me that's not in the report. I think I'm going crazy, right? And then the next thing was this parental alienation syndrome. And I said, parental alienation? I said, I bent over backwards for this man to be in her life. I had a great relationship with my own father, and I wanted her to have a chance to have the same. This child's going into foster care with no grounds whatsoever. She's in my care. I'm the sole caretaker ever. You know, that's the bonded relationship, really. He had minimal visitation, and they are going to put her in foster care. I'm, like, in shock. I just hired an attorney the day before, and I heard him say to her on the phone, the GAL door, he goes, you take that baby from her mother, and I will have your butt. And then I went and laid my head down on the desk, and I was crying. I wasn't out of control because they would have said, look, that mother's emotionally inept. You've got to take her away. I tried to hold it together, right? And they came in, and they tapped me on the shoulder, social worker, really coldly, and says, you can go say goodbye to your daughter now. And I couldn't even walk. I couldn't get up. My legs were like just rubber. I was in shock. It was a gray mist around me. I remember walking down a hallway, and I could hear them echoing in the background, look at her, look at her. She can't handle it. She can't say goodbye to her daughter. And I just kind of put my arm out to the side and said, oh, yes, I can. And I want to make sure I said goodbye to my baby, because we were going roller skating that day, and I didn't want her to think I just left her and abandoned her. She didn't know why I was leaving. And they had the police escort me out. Can you imagine? And I just drove directly to Dr. Baker's office, and tears streaming, makeup all over my face. I walked in, she goes, what happened to you? And I said, my God, you know the truth. You fight for us. They just took her from me. And she was sick. So from that point on, the GAL controlled the whole case. That's what happens in these cases. The guardian ad litem, who's a lawyer for the child, is controlling the whole weight of the case. The judge doesn't really know what's going on, and she was pushing the PAS syndrome thing, and parental alienation syndrome. And so every time I went to court with more evidence of abuse or doctor's reports or police reports, she would ask to give the father more time. And the psychologist that states my daughter's being abused removes her from the case and puts on a psychologist to do no abuse therapy. So no matter what my daughter told this next therapist, it was like hushed. And this went on for several years, obviously. I never stopped fighting. I was in court for 10 years trying to protect my daughter. I lost her at the age of 5 to the abuser with all the evidence and all the proof of it, and probably, I don't know how many witnesses. I had tons of news media coverage on my case here in Colorado. 7 News covered it incredibly well and extensively and did an exceptional job. And then I lobbied in Washington, D.C. I testified before Congress. I never, ever stopped turning over a leash to get her home and get her safe. And I was forced into supervised visits because I said I was going to run with her. I mean, I wasn't ever intending to run with my child. I didn't believe that was the answer for the child or myself, and the fact that I didn't believe the system could ignore all this evidence. So I would have never ran. But anyway, I'm in supervised visits in a little room, 8 by 10 feet, treated as a hardened criminal. I mean, worse than a hardened criminal, because they have more visitation than I did. I had 1 hour a week with her, and I watched her be so traumatized, I can't even tell you. I watched her. She was beautiful. I couldn't walk down the street without people stopping me to talk to her. Her eyes danced. Miss personality. I'm watching. She had beautiful, thick, long, dark hair, and these little blue eyes that danced, and now they're in a trance-like state. And her hair is falling out, and she's gained a tremendous amount of weight. And there were points where I would be in visits with her, and all I could do was be a therapist for that hour, trying to keep her as normal as I could and let her know how much I loved her and how much her family loved her. She had a great family, and her grandparents adored her. Everybody in my family adored her. All the people that loved her and were trying to protect her, she was isolated from and shut down. And so it's the most heartbreaking thing, and I'd like to say I'm the only one that ever went through this, and maybe if I was, I'd say, oh, they just made some horrific mistakes. I promise there are thousands and thousands of these cases, and I get sick every time I hear another mom calling me and said, my two little girls, both of them, are being abused. What do I do? What can I do? How can I stop this? Where can I go? What attorney do I get? My book, I started writing when I saw the system failing. So she was probably 2.5, 3 when I started writing the book. And I documented everything. And that's what I tell these mothers to do is document. It's so important. And I get a big legal binder and just document all the important parts of your case. And so my book is an emotional story, which is heart-wrenching. It's gut-wrenching. But once you get through that, I have all the documentation. So if you read in some part in the book, chapter, it says that the police report, and it says go to Addendum A. Well, there's the police report. So you can't believe this could happen. I've got all the research and the documentation to prove what was happening in my case. So you just go back to the back of the book, and it's all there. So it's just an educational tool for judges, lawyers, psychologists, social workers, anybody involved. And for the women out there, they're trying to protect their children and aren't getting blindsided by the system. So anyway, I lost my daughter for 8 years to supervised visits, and I got her back when she was 12 and a half or 13. That's after I went on CNN International News, and I do believe that had a major play in me getting my daughter back. I don't think I would have ever gotten her back, and I was bankrupted, hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees, and most of these women are bankrupted. They can't even afford the supervised visits because they can't afford them. I mean, and not only can they not afford them, it's so emotionally debilitating, it kills you. I mean, it's worse than the court was, which they treated you like crud. I mean, I've never been treated so horrifically in my life, and I can't explain what that's like. But I mean, I was in court for a day, I was in court for weeks and months at a time. So this was not just going for a day here and a day there. I mean, it would actually schedule for weeks. And the trauma of that is horrific. And then watching your child suffer in a supervised visit setting like that and not being able to get her home is another side of this. But she always said to me, Mommy, I fly to your house at night, and I'm always on the windowsill. I'm always with you. And she never let go, and I never let go. And I think those supervised visits, how horrific they are, if you can afford to stay in there and emotionally you can get through it, you got to stay in those visits because your child knows you're still fighting for him, and your child knows you're still there. They don't feel abandoned. And I think that's what helped her survive. And once I got her home, I just told her, I said, see all those files under my desk? That's your case. And when you're ready to deal with it someday, it's there for you. And I never brought up anything ever again. All I did was try to get her back healthy and normal as much as I could, give her as much love as I could, open my home up to her family, friends, so she had somewhat of normalcy again. And then and I didn't publish the book until she was older, and I told her I was publishing the book, and she says, you go for it, Mom. I just won't read it. She's dissociative. She had to block this stuff out in order to survive. That's what children do. It was so traumatic for her, but she's just now coming out of dissociation, and it's been really, really tough. But she's incredible. She's an incredible, incredible woman. She's a woman now. So that's my story, and I've spent the rest of my life since this and even during this, helping others and helping other women and children and bringing this to light and writing and speaking. And I guess I believe it's my passion, it's my mission in life. I didn't really choose it. I didn't really want it, but I have it. That's it, Richard.
Well, I applaud you for your persistence, to say the very least, obviously because there's a child involved. If obviously this is now, it's taken over your life. This is what you're doing. Before all of this happened, what was it that you wanted to do with your life? Where did you want to be today? Had none of this happened, it had been a normal family situation and your daughter grew up healthy and your husband was still there and so on and so forth. What was your passion back then?
Oh, you're going to make me cry because I don't go there. It's like I did have plans. I probably would have had more children. I know I would have. I love kids. I wanted to go to law school, so that was my goal in life, was to go to law school. had to learn a lot of law without being an attorney. But I would have just wanted to be happy. I was very happy, fun. I'm still fun and happy, but I was very outgoing, had lots of friends. Carefree life, I guess nothing really touched me. I guess I have to say that. I mean, I grew up in a very happy home life, great family, 6 kids, down home, good, great, wonderful parents. So I didn't really know anything ugly like this and didn't understand that. I couldn't even have comprehended that our judicial system, I just believed in everything. I believed the system would do what was right. If something would prevail to be right, this just couldn't possibly go the direction it went. So I think I would have just been a happy mom and possibly an attorney and possibly doing other things in my life, not this.
Yeah.
But I don't regret it to this point. It's incredible that to know you're out there making a difference and helping others, and the letters I get or the help, you know, women that I, even though maybe I didn't change their direction, I helped them get through it in a way that nobody could because they saw me, they know I suffered the same consequences. So it gives them strength. When I get up and speak at a battered mother's conference, these women are coming in from all over the United States and they're begging and borrowing to get there because most of them are depleted financially. And when I speak, I'm still dying inside. I will probably die inside the rest of my life. It's not a pain that goes away necessarily. I mean, I get reminded of it when I see a little girl crying in the grocery store. Lots of things will bring that because I'm sure I have PTSD and I have lots of trauma from it myself. But I get up and I speak from my gut and I give them hope. And to them, they look at me as a strong woman that made it through this. And look what she's doing, and I want to be her someday. I want to do what she's doing. And so that's my goal, is to give that hope out there, that you can get your children back, you can make a difference, and we all have to go in it together, that's all.
I realize this is not, this program, as you have heard, is about choices. And I'm a firm believer that we always have, I don't care what the situation is, you always have choices. Nelson Mandela was in prison with a 25-year sentence, and he had choices even there, and he made one, and it propelled him to the presidency of South Africa. And I realize this is not—I'm just throwing this out there. You know,
okay.
You could have just said, I'm just going to walk away. I can't—I don't want to deal with this, and I'm just going to wash my hands of this and move on, in spite of the fact that this was— your flesh and blood.
I couldn't do it. Oh my gosh, it would have been really, not great, but it would have been, I remember my mom telling me, oh my God, you should be a drug addict, an alcoholic, you should be deathly ill. And I've watched the women that were strong like I was, and at the beginning of all this, back in the 80s, I had a rally at the Capitol here in Colorado, and women came in from all across the nation, senators and congressmen and musicians, and it was really a great grassroots effort. And I still have all that on tape. And those women got up to speak, coming in from all those different states. And one of them said, how many here are from California? And then, they raised their hand. How about Montana? She went through every state, and there were women from every state. And that woman was very strong and very educated and a very loving mother, strong Christian, and she... That faith was keeping her going, but today she's bedridden. And I watched another one that went in the underground and didn't make it. I watched another mother that was an attorney that committed suicide. So I've seen it all. And I think that this has been my choice to continue. But I couldn't walk away from my daughters. I just could not do it. I was dying inside knowing where she was and not being able to do anything. That was not life to me. I remember people trying to get me to go out, or even date at some points. And I couldn't live till I got her home. I just was not here. I remember one man saying to me, I worked for the airlines, and I had been in management with the airlines for many years. And I now was, I went back to flying on the line as a flight attendant so I could free up my time to lobby in Washington, D.C. to fight for my daughter. And three at my time period, because it takes 24/7 to work on this stuff. And I remember this pilot, after I got my daughter home, he says, oh, my God, You said your eyes were dead. They're back. It's because I got my daughter back.
Hmm. What about her choices, your daughter's choices? What about what she wants to do with her life now?
She's pretty incredible. You know what she'll say to me, and I think this is so, she's way beyond her years and spiritually way beyond, and I believe she's going to make a difference in some other direction. I don't know what that will be, but she says to me, Mom, we were chosen for this. Not that it was our choice, like what you're saying, we make our choices, but we have become who we've become because of this. And she said, you're on your journey, I'm on my journey. You know, we'll meet up. And it's she's, well, ask me that question again about how she is. Ask me again, Richard.
Well,
please.
Let me put it another way. How old is she now?
She's 30.
30. Can you tell me, I would love to be asking her this question because I ask this question of all my guests. What's her life's purpose? What's what she want to do with her life? I mean, she's been through the ringer, to say the very least. She's got trauma that won't quit until the day she dies, probably. And hopefully it's a long life just the same. I'm sure she's going to be in therapy if she isn't already in the same context. For the rest of her life. It would be nice if someday she was able to reach a place, and I realize this probably sounds rather horrific, where she'll be able to forgive him, but that's probably, you know, maybe decades off.
You're going to be amazed at this, that, you know, oh, I don't know how to explain it, but she still loves her father. It isn't, and she's dissociative, or she's blocked it to the point she knows that she does, she is in therapy now, but all up until now, she hasn't really dealt with it. She's just now starting to deal with it. But she believes her purpose is very, very large. I don't know exactly. I mean, some of the things she tells me, maybe I don't know. I think I put some stuff in my book, the new book that just came out, and how she says, I'm just going to read this to you if you don't mind. This is my last chapter says, when the dreamers, the protectors, and the warriors survive. And I said, Amy has proven to be an incredible young woman. And she tells me her goal is to make a difference someday for children. She recently sent me a message stating, I went from a 3 or 4 year old where everything stopped. I could not access my being until now. I am back. I can't believe it. A 4 year old soul and a 25 year old daughter's body. She can dance, sing, swim. She has studied humanity and traveled the world, ending by her true love by the sea, where she gets to be her true mermaid, loving her little kingdom by the sea. We get it, Mom. It's just the beginning of so much work to do, and I am ready. Thank you for always being on the journey with me, my number one supporter. I am real and solid in my body that is all mine. I have not felt my body in so long, the texture of my skin, the water on my scalp, nor have I seen my own shadow constantly in motion. I stop for no one. I am a butterfly that disappears just as soon as you catch a glimpse. I am deep into my spirituality and let go of all that I thought was my existence. I now can access all my powers that have been locked away for so long. There is nothing that will get in my way now as long as I listen to my voice. I made it to the other side, Mom. Love you so much. And this is another message she wrote. She said, your baby is alive and feels the beauty of everything that is around her. She just had a major detour. But she is who you always knew she would be. It just took some time. I can't even read it. You are exactly who she picked to guide her in her life. Keep doing what you're doing. She needs you to keep fighting, and it's 100% worth it. You are creating a beautiful existence. Mm. Us and the convertible seeing our hearts out. I remember everything and have always been with you. Love you, Mama, and your beautiful soul. So, you know, she's pretty incredible, you know. When she was like 12 and a half, she wrote this. I am a dreamer. Well, this is, she was 12 and a half years old. I am a dreamer. This shows her dissociativeness. I am a dreamer lost in the world of logic and order. I wonder how big the universe really is. I hear the tinkling of fairies everywhere. I see an open ocean filled with mermaids diving in and out of the waves. I'm a dreamer lost in the world of logic and order. I pretend to glide in and out of the clouds with a flying unicorn. I feel that when I enter my world, everything is peaceful. I touch the barrier between the dream world and reality. I worry that someday my special world will collide with the real. I'm a dreamer lost in the world of logic and order. I understand that my dreams might never come true. I say that my world will last forever. I dream that I'm on a star looking down at the world. I try to keep my two worlds from becoming one. I hope my special world will never end, for it is my salvation from the troubles of life. I'm a dreamer lost in the world of logic and order.
Powerful, powerful stuff, folks. I want you to stay with us. We're going to take a quick break, take a little breather here. We hope that you will stay with us here on Tell Me Your Story. We're talking with Marilee McLean, and she has written a book. We certainly hope that you will get a copy of. Go to her website. We'll give that to you after the break. Prosecuted but not silenced, courtroom reform for sexually abused children. And we're going to try to look at the positive side of all of this as we continue here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Stay tuned.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Well, this is something that for some of us is kind of hard to understand. How in the world, in this, I'm going to put it in this context, folks, in this supposed great country of ours, that these kinds of things can happen. It just doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever, Marilee McLean. Thank you so much for staying with us here on the program and for sharing this particular story. This is, I'm actually, it's a big problem for somebody who's on the radio to be speechless. I don't have kids. I have animals, and I get frustrated at them sometimes. And, you know, I have to catch myself, and even I have to catch myself yelling at them, sit, stop, because that's not helping the situation. And yet we have a system, an institution, as some might say, that is equal to, if not worse than, the abuse that they are there to try to get out of. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, exactly.
It's just astounding. We were talking before the break about your daughter. You were reading some letters that she had written as she was growing. Actually, one at 25, one at 12. And I'd asked you about what she wanted to do. And this actually goes to the core of, from my perspective, anytime we have individuals in our society, in any country, it doesn't matter, who are put in harm's way, that's probably the best generic phrase that I can come up with. My first thought goes to the lost potential.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
The lost contribution, this individual, that's why I asked you the question about yourself. What in the heck would you rather be doing if you didn't have to deal with this mess? Why is it that we have people in our society, in our culture, who never get the chance to fulfill their potential, to live out the purpose for which they may have come here for, depending upon your philosophical beliefs and so forth?
Right.
And yet at the same time, maybe your daughter probably phrased it the best in saying that you, Marilee, were put here to do just what you're doing. What do you think about that? What is your feeling about that?
Well, I know she said to me when she was even little, really little, she said, "Mommy, I was on a star looking down, and I knew you were going to be my mommy. I picked you for my mommy." So, I mean, I think that's really strange for a little trained child to say. And I think, I don't know that I was picked for this. I don't know how that all happens. I mean, I know you say you make your choices. I made my choice by marrying the man I married. That was my choice. That was my direction to go in this direction. I think my life would have been entirely different had I not married him. So that part of it. As far as she goes, I think she's on a journey, like she said. she's just now coming out of this, and there were a lot of things that held her back. Like, she had compartmentalized everything in her brain. So now all that's coming together. And so she said, "My gosh, Mom, I can dance," because she was a great dancer when she was little. "She can dance. She's a great swimmer. She's a great this, that." All her knowledge, because it took her forever to get through college. I mean, she's brilliant, but had a really hard time getting through all that. And she, everything she studied, she said, is coming at her in fast pace. You know, she's getting everything. She's understanding everything. Everything's just like an awakening, I guess is what you would call it. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not like maybe you are, Richard, where I figured all this out of the whys and where we're going to go. I just know I've been put here to do this, and I know this is my mission, and I just know it. I feel it inside. I think if let's say God wanted me to do something else or would have shut this down. I remember when I went on CNN International News, and I kept calling friends of mine going, should I do this? Should I go on CNN? Because it was a catch-22. If I go on, I may never see my daughter again, or if I go on, I may get her back. But which should I do? And every one of them said, "No, Lee, my gosh, we can't make that decision for you. You've got to make that on your own." And I just prayed to God about it. And I said, "God, you know, leave this door open if you want CNN to go, and close it if you don't." And CNN went, and it was really a good thing. So I believe that way. I believe that I don't believe that abusers should get away with what they're doing and ruining, destroying children's lives. And I don't believe that I don't want to believe that my daughter was selected for this journey. She believes that she's more spiritual than I am. I think it's really ugly, and I can't believe that she was picked out for this, for her journey, for her life. Whatever the end is, like what you said with Mandel, maybe there's a whole other thing to this that we all can't see. I don't know what that is. You know, what that future holds, I don't know.
Well, it's an astounding story, to say the very least. We certainly want people to be aware of it. That's why we bring it to you. And to me, again, I go back to what I said earlier in the last segment about our criminal justice system seeking out evidence of a particular crime and immediately, boom, you're guilty because the evidence is pointing to you, which I still find irreprehensible because they haven't gathered all the evidence yet. And yet they've already come to a conclusion one third or halfway through the gathering of the evidence. Whereas, as you've described, you've got all the evidence in front of you. How much more do you need? And you're still blind? I mean, justice is supposed to be blind, but not that blind.
Right. You know, that you reminded me of something. I went to the DA several times. I had that black book, like I tell you all mothers should get, and put all the documentation in there so that when they go talk to a congressman or a senator or you know, an attorney to work with them or whatever. Well, I took that into the DA here in Colorado with Bob Gallagher at the time, and I said, "My God, Gallagher, you prosecute the cases with one-tenth the evidence. Why are you not prosecuting this case?" And he admitted, "I believe your child is being abused. And we'll see what that lower court judge does. And if he takes that child away from you, we will step in to do something." I lost my daughter, and he never stepped in to do anything. And so a lot of these DAs, they don't want to do a case that they don't believe they can prove it beyond a reasonable doubt because it hurts their record. It hurts their, you know, showing, "Hey, I've got this many rape cases, and I've won this many rape cases." So that's some of it. But really, oh, no, this needs to be prosecuted. My gosh, if I was raped, or your girlfriend or wife or whoever was raped, that goes into criminal court. A child being raped, and it goes into family court because it's the father, excuse me, it's rape.
Yeah. I don't know. I like I said, I am dumbfounded, and at the same time, there's a part of me that's actually not that surprised with the fact that in the judicial system, it's supposed to be seeking the truth, but it's not seeking the truth. You actually said it about this one gentleman who was supposed to help you out, and he didn't do it. You know, it's not about seeking the truth and justice. It's about winning and losing. That's
right.
Yeah,
right.
It's like, wait
a
minute.
I mean, there are cases where a guy just got out of prison, okay, for raping a 7-year-old or 8-year-old little girl. And he has now a 7 or 8-year-old little girl. and he got full custody of her. You know, I mean, and the mom is claiming abuse with this little girl, and the mom has no rights to her. I have so many cases that would blow everybody listening out there's minds of how many case after case after case. And there are lots of organizations working on this. You've got Stop Abuse Now, California Protective Parents Association, Center for Judicial Excellence. You know, Minnesota has, Barry Goldstein has written incredible books and articles on this, and he's out of Minnesota. And, wow, it's unbelievable. Fight Back Foundation that I work with, and here in Colorado, we started a court watch program, but we couldn't get into the cases because most of these cases will be domestic violence cases that move into the abuse of the children, but they're sealed. So you can't get in and court watch what's going on. They seal the courtroom. So like in my case, they would seal the courtroom, and I would be torn apart to smithereens in there for hours at a time. I was ordered to pay all court costs, pay the father's attorney's fees, pay for child support, pay all therapist costs. In other words, they bankrupt you and to shut you up. Jeez. And I got a gag order at the same time. So I remember, I mean, I couldn't even tell you the days I spent in court where they'd seal the courtroom and you'd be... Social services would be on one side of the courtroom, and you'd be over here by yourself. And the lies flying around the courtroom, and that, oh my God, it's all in my book. People would have to go read it and understand what's going on, and really put out there to stop this. We know we have problems in the system, and this has got to be stopped.
What has this done to your faith, your philosophy of life?
Well, I'm a believer. I believe in God, obviously, so that's helped me through a lot of it. I'm not somebody that goes out there and preaches, or I've never been that, but I feel God in my soul and feel Him with me, or Jesus. But that isn't it. I think my philosophy is the world isn't what I thought it was, but I grew up in an upbringing, like I told you, it was apple pie, you know, perfect little... Nobody has a perfect life, but it was pretty close. And so I wasn't prepared for this. I don't think you ever could be prepared for this one, but I see what's going on. This comes from the top up. I mean, this abuse isn't just here in the family court system and protecting abusers, and we know what the Catholic priests are doing. This goes all the way to the top. I have found, even when you're lobbying, and you'll find how high up this really goes. So that's the thing that's scary to me, is that this is bigger than I ever dreamed it to be. And I don't usually talk about that because I don't want to scare people, but I've learned a lot, and that's the shocking part to me. There are people very high up that are involved in all this. And we have, I don't want to say it's, you know, there's fathers' rights funding, and I'm not against fathers because I love men and I love good fathers. We're not talking about good fathers here. And our federal government funds billions into fathers' rights funding, which that means when these guys come out of prison, they automatically get their children. It doesn't get custody of them because they're back with money. They don't have to pay child support that way. There's a lot of things that the government could do differently. That would, there's no mothers' rights funding. You know, there's no such thing as mother.gov, or, you know, so there, people need to look into that and see what's going on there. That's one of them. There's lots of other things, lots of other avenues. It's just like when this Me Too movement started, I believe this is a part of the Me Too. And I think equal rights amendment, you know, women having equal rights, we aren't close to having equal rights if we can't keep our children safe. I know every woman in the United States would give up her salary in a minute to protect her children. And you will give up your salary to protect your children if you end up in family court. But what I'm saying is that is minute compared to trying to fight for your children. And if you think you have equal rights, go into our family court and you'll see how much equal rights you have. You do not. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to say it's a patriarchal society or anything. I don't want to go into all that or male entitlement. I'm not against men. I'm not male entitlement. I am safety of the child and looking at the child first. I don't care about anything else. Just to stop the nonsense out there and do what's right by these children.
I realize that this is a side issue of sorts, although it's sort of to the core. What research has been done into the causes of this sexual abuse by adults. Mm-hmm. Is it because they were, is it typically because they were abused as children,
you know,
and
that,
carry it forward?
I heard you say that earlier on. Excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I don't think, I mean, not every person that's been sexually abused goes out to abuse again. I mean, you know, that we know that for a fact. I mean, that is a possibility, obviously, but a lot of them that have would never touch another child or ever do anything like that. But I think, you know, it stemmed from generations of this and not being protected and all of that. I don't know. It's in a cycle. And to stop it, I think we need the ACE research, like I mentioned earlier, adverse childhood experiences, so we catch it early, that we, it's like, you know, when we had the smoking campaign to not smoke, and everybody knew what the health cost was to that smoking, this is the same thing. This is a health cost to society. So I think that would be one way to stop what's going on. But to stop the mentality of an abuser, I mean, I think, like, I'll talk to men that are good fathers and loving fathers, and they can't even comprehend how a father could rape his own child. It just, it absolutely boggles their mind. Where that comes from, I don't know, where they get that urge or why they do. I have no answer for that. A lot of it's about control, you know, control and power over something small, something that they can control. You know, it's a sickness.
And
I don't believe you can cure it. I don't believe you can take a pedophile. They always say this, and I kind of believe it because what I've experienced, so maybe I'm wrong, and some psychologists out there can come and tell me, no, we can cure it. But once a pedophile, always a pedophile. You know, it's not curable. It's not something they're going to go, I'm not going to ever, but probably, I don't know. I'm not going to go into it. I just don't know.
Well, I know that it's a subject for another program, probably in a different venue than ours per se, but I certainly felt a need to kind of delve into that, because it's one thing that where we have a problem at one end of this process, and then that's what you're dealing with. But if we can't find a way to at least curb this kind of activity in our population, then, you know, I don't see a lot of hope for us as a civilization. And this is just one, I want to say one small area. It's not small, but this is just one area that we're talking about today. You know, and it's like, there've got to be some solutions, and you know, maybe we're not, as I said, you and I, we're not in a place right now with this program where we can really address those solutions. But the process that you went through, the judicial process, there are solutions.
Well, that would be a big part of it, because if you figure you got 58,000 children a year that are forced to go over those abusers, and I believe that number is way higher than that. That research was done probably 10 years ago. But I think if you stopped the courts from doing what they're doing and these children not being abused, and if you relate it to the people that are abusing in a different, not letting them off the hook by any means, mm-hmm. but, you know, I know this one man that he does, he's supposedly supposed to cure pedophiles, so he does trainings and stuff, and domestic violence abusers and that kind of thing, and I asked him what his ratio was. Can you give me any proof of, you know, and he said, no, we're not there yet. But, you know, I think the ACE study research would be the best possible solution to curb some of this health cost and this damage. I really do, if people would listen.
Hmm. Well, again, it's an unbelievable.
And then I believe the training and education for the system in itself. That means psychologists, social workers, judges, lawyers, all of them have to have more training understanding domestic violence and child abuse.
I also sometimes wonder what is on the minds. See, because these institutions, whether it be CPS and all of the people that work in there and the people that work in the judicial system and so forth, as I have used the word now twice, these are people. These are human beings. And I sit there wondering, what is it that's motivating them to continue to perpetrate the problems that exist in these institutions?
Look at it this way, Richard. They're not looking at, they would, it's much easier for a judge to say this is a vindictive ex-wife or not look at the evidence than to have to deal with that. Believe me, it's huge. And it's money-making. I'm not saying this is about money, but this is big dollars with social services. This is big dollars. Every time they put a child in foster care, they get $5,000.
What?
You know, and it's millions and billions. We're talking lots and lots of money here. And think of the court process. When you go in there as a woman or a man trying to deal with the court process, we're talking big bucks here because you've got to have a GAO, you've got to have an evaluation, you've got to have this therapist, you have to have a mediator. I mean, pretty soon you're going through your child's college education, you're going through everything you ever had, you're giving up your homes, they're losing everything. So no, this is part of it too. I don't like to go into the money because I really think it's deeper than that on a deeper level, but it is the money too.
Is this also part of, so to speak, the pendulum swinging back the other way? Because it used to be that when you had custody issues in divorces, especially, the mother, that's where the kid went, period. No, end of story. Father was done. And now it's like it's swinging back the other way. And I realize we're talking maybe apples and oranges here in that regard. But again, we're still talking about parents fighting over the custody of the child. And yes, this is under sexual abuse.
You know, this is the difference. You know, you're right. The pendulum has swung like that. But I think in the 70s and then with women's, you know, rights coming out, I mean, not what rights, but VAWA Act getting passed in 1994, a lot of that. When women got jobs and they're in the workforce, it did go to where, you know, there are fathers that are stay-at-home dads and parents that, you know, want 50-50 custody of their children when they divorce. Well, that is great on paper, absolutely wonderful when they can do it. But when there's abuse, like I said earlier in this conversation, that is not plausible. Mm-hmm. And it is not 50-50. And a lot of states are going 50-50. That eases up the judge to have to deal with all the crap, like in my case. Mm-hmm. If it's automatically 50-50, they don't have to deal with anything, do they? The father gets 50, the mom gets 50. But when you do that and there's abuse going on, you're forcing that child to live in an abusive situation for 50% of the time. How much more damage are we going to cause that child? You know?
Yeah.
So that's part of it. And the pendulum swinging, you know, I believe, you know, you can say women and children have been a chattel to men back in, you know, the old day. Absolutely, that's the way it was. And then there was a period where women got custody, no matter what, they were stay-at-home moms or whatever, and they weren't in the workforce. And now it's swung to the direction that in cases where there is abuse going on, 70% of contested custody cases where there's abuse going on, those children are going to the abuser. And when there's sexual abuse going on, 90% of those cases, the children are going to the abuser. There's a new study that was just done by Joan Myers. She's out of George Washington University. She's a lawyer. And she did a huge research study by the Justice Office, another study I'm giving you besides Saunders. And that study proves not just the gender bias thing, but how many of these cases are going in the wrong direction. She's got men and women. She's done the study. She did the research off 4,000 cases where there was domestic violence and child abuse. Exceptional research to show what's going on.
Incredible. Well, I have to say that, again, this particular subject is not an easy one to talk about, but it's one that needs to be talked about because it's going on. It's been going on, quite honestly, folks, for decades. And unfortunately, I don't see it ending anytime in the foreseeable future. But maybe through Marilee McLean's work, through the book that she has written, Prosecuted But Not Silenced, Courtroom Reform for Sexually Abused Children, hopefully, and it sounds to me like you are making inroads and you are making changes to the system and making people aware that they need to open their eyes to what's going on, because I hate using the phrase, our children are our future, and if all we're going to do is manufacture more abused people growing up to be adults to do the continuation of abusing, I might as well give up on all of the dreams for our civilization for decades to come, because this is all we're going to be dealing with. So let's try to fix some of this. I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the program, sharing this this particular story, and I'm hoping that people will pick up a copy of your book. What is the website that you would like to send people to so that they can get more information as well as a copy of your book?
Okay, I always do my three W's. I don't know if they're necessary.
They are not.
But it's just my name. Maralee, M-A-R-A-L-E-E, McLean, M-C, capital L-E-A-N, .com. And then also, it's on, my book is Barnes & Noble, Amazon. Lots of bookstores have it, so you just have to ask for it. But it's out there. So, and you can actually get it on my website, too. So.
All right. MaraleeMcLean.com, the website. The book, once again, is Prosecuted But Not Silenced, Courtroom Reform for Sexually Abused Children. And sadly, you know, we're still dealing with the whole Catholic Church thing. And then, and it's the funny thing about it, if I can use that term, is that, yes, the Catholic Church is getting a lot of attention, but I would venture that it is not exclusive to the Catholic Church. I'm sure that other philosophies, as I like to use the term, are just as guilty in some instances of abusing their parishioners, their laity, their participants, if you will. And yeah, it's something that certainly we need to talk about. Maralee, before I let you go, I have three final questions that I ask all of my guests, regardless of the conversation. And again, I thank you for giving us so much time. I do want to remind our listeners that all you hear on the radio broadcast is 50 minutes of this conversation. There's more. I call it the after view. And the only way that you can hear that is if you go to the radio show's page of richarddugan.com, go to SoundCloud, go to iTunes to listen to the interview in its entirety. We really implore you to do so, as well as go to her website, MaraleeMcLean.com. We will be linked to your website as well. First question I have for you is, who is Maralee McLean?
Oh, wow. That's a tough one. I am a loving mother. I'm a fighter. I believe in the protection of our children, obviously. I guess, what else could I say? I'm an advocate. And I love society, and I want to make a difference.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
I want to wake up society. I want them to know that this isn't, maybe not in your home, but it's in your neighbor's home. It will touch you at some point in your life, whether it's a sister or a niece or a son or whoever, but it will touch you. So don't shy away from it. Get involved. And I think I answered your question.
And finally, you've probably addressed this during the interview, but I'll ask it just the same. What is your life's purpose?
To make a difference, to change what's happening, and to live my life to the fullest as much as I can and enjoy life, but also to make sure my daughter gets through this and that I help others.
Well, it sounds like she's doing pretty darn good, and she's got someone on her in her corner. You've got her, as they say in the military, you've got her six. And we are grateful that you have brought this this subject to our attention on this particular program, and we certainly hope that you continue to make inroads to continue to force change, because that's what it's going to take in the system, so that our kids grow up to be well-adjusted, healthy, both mentally as well as physically, emotionally and spiritually. And again, I thank you so much for giving us so much time on the program.
And Richard, what an incredible job you've done. Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure to be on with you.
I
really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love, Talal.